01-1193, Johnson Controls, Inc. v. Employers Insurance of Wausau et al. Our first counsel will be Matthew Flynn, who will represent Johnson Controls. Mr. Flynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Matthew Flynn of the firm of Quarles & Brady in Milwaukee. And I have the privilege of representing Johnson Controls in this action. At the outset, I'd like to say something about the action that is obvious and may seem obvious, but perhaps it's been forgotten at some points during the litigation. And I think it's very important in this litigation. And that is, this is an insurance case. It's a contract case, a case involving a contract of insurance. And Wisconsin law on insurance is very familiar to all of us. And it's really been a national pace setter in the area. In Wisconsin, we give effect to the reasonable expectations of the insured. In Wisconsin, we interpret words and phrases in a common sense way, as a layperson would understand them, not in a technical or legal way. Here in our state, if there are any ambiguities, we resolve them in favor of the insured, because the insurance companies drafted the agreements frequently with boilerplate provisions as an industry. In Wisconsin, if there is no ambiguity, we apply the words as written. We apply every phrase and every word that's in the contract, and we give effect to the intention of the parties. This is boilerplate law. I don't think that anybody in this courtroom could disagree with that. This particular case involves CGL policies, and I would just like to read, just so that we refresh ourselves as to what the words are of that CGL policy. The CGL policy at issue, comprehensive general liability, says the company will pay on behalf of the insured all sums which the insured shall become legally obligated to pay as damages because of property damage caused by an occurrence. Now, let me stop there. This CGL policy does not say that there's an exclusion if the government is a party or plaintiff. Doesn't say there's an exclusion if the judge is sitting in law or equity. And to be truthful, if the average small business owner in this state were to buy a CGL policy and you asked him what's equity, he'd think it's his ownership in his house. He would not know what law and equity is. He really wouldn't, and I think we all know that. He also, if you were to say to him, well, if the government sues you, all bets are off, I think he'd say, no, wait a minute. This is a known and unknown hazards policy. I didn't bargain for an exclusion that if the government is a plaintiff, all bets are off. Now, in this case, I think it's important to know what Johnson Controls seeks, because issues have come up, and I anticipate we'll be discussing the Shorewood case, the Edgerton case. What Johnson Controls is seeking in this case are money that it paid either in its own cleanup or to other parties, governmental entities or to private parties, to clean up property that had been damaged or injured, polluted, damaged, water, land. And the question arises, before we get into any discussion of the cases, are those damages? And I would note the words of Justice Crooks, speaking for the court in the Hills case, where he said, it has long been the law of the state that the cost of repairing and restoring damaged property and water to its original condition is a proper measure of compensatory damages. Now, to the extent there was any dispute about that before, there's certainly no dispute about that after Hills. And the court went on in Hills to say, because liability policies are intended to protect insureds from negligent acts resulting in damage to third parties, an insured, when buying comprehensive liability coverage, expects that any activity resulting in an unintended and unexpected property damage to a third party will be covered unless it is specifically excluded. Now, in this case, Your Honors, there were originally 21 Superfund sites at issue. And in these Superfund sites, and they're all listed in some detail in the briefs, I want to emphasize again that Johnson Controls has not and is not seeking any money for cleaning up, in other words, changing its manufacturing process to prevent events in the future. This is all money to clean water and land that was polluted, whether it's by, there's a lot of technologies, caps of some sort, barriers of some sort, breaking up of the property, that kind of thing. And of these 21 properties, three of them are owned or were owned by Johnson Controls. The rest are not. And I will, this is a smaller issue in the case, which I'd like to address in a little bit, but our position on that is that with respect to two of those three, water was polluted, water was damaged, and in one of them, the state of Michigan, as in Wisconsin, water is owned by the state. It is a third party that owned that water that was damaged. In the state of Indiana, the water is not owned by the state. It's owned by the individual, the property owner, but the water in that case then migrated onto a third party property and damaged it. Now, why did Johnson Controls clean this up, whether by doing it itself or by responding to cost recovery actions and other actions? And the answer is very simple. Under CERCLA, which was passed in about 1980, amended in 1985, 1986, there are a number of ways in which the government and other private parties can allocate costs for cleaning up toxic sites, polluted sites around the country. One of them, initially, is what we call a Section 104 request for information. Johnson Controls did not run out and start cleaning up anything just on a request for information. The next is what's called a potentially responsible party letter. This is at the core of this case. It's an extremely important issue, and I want to address it right now. When somebody gets a potentially responsible party letter, this isn't an invitation. This isn't a get-well card. This isn't something nice to receive. It's adversarial. It is, there's the power of the government behind it. It is potentially very costly to the insured. And in one of the cases we cited that I do commend to the court's attention, in Utah, the Quaker State case, there's a very, very good description of the perils of ignoring a potentially responsible party letter. And if the perils are these. If you ignore it and the government goes on to file a UAO action, a unilateral administrative order under Section 106, they can recover ultimately $25,000 a day in fines and penalties. Now it's $27,500. They've increased it. They can clean it up themselves and then sue you in a cost recovery action. And if they do, the cost will be vastly more than the cost for a private party to do it for a variety of reasons. Anecdotally, down in one of our sites where homes were damaged, I think the government was cleaning it up for about $24,000 a site, and we stepped in and cleaned it up for $10,000 a site. Why? Why? Because the government has prevailing wage Davis-Bacon responsibilities, which in the abstract I applaud, but the fact of the matter is they have them. Number two, the government also is not as good as private industry in controlling costs. One expert could go out on the site if Johnson Controls sends them and does the job. Three or four experts may go out if the EPA is involved. So there are a lot of reasons to step in. There's another reason to step in, and that is under CERCLA, if you ignore a potentially responsible party letter and somebody else does the cleanup, and then there's a contribution litigation afterwards, there's an equitable set of factors, and your lack of compliance equitably hurts you in that cost recovery from another potentially responsible party, and you are helped if you've complied. In other words, it saves you money. But finally, and I saved what I think is the most important to last, the most important reason has nothing to do with, or it has a lot to do with what I've just described, but it really has to do with this. If you ignore a potentially responsible party letter, and you've checked your internal records, and there's no dispute in this case that Johnson Control shipped either chemicals or was a user of these sites, you are letting pollution increase. You're letting it seep farther into the groundwater, farther out into the groundwater, increasing damage, increasing costs, but much more importantly, increasing danger to the public and to adjacent landowners. Now, what Johnson Controls did in this case, and it exercised a great deal of judgment, I think, and it responded to many of these potentially responsible party requests, and it cleaned it up itself because it could do it cheaper. Now, right out, I'd like to address this issue. The argument is made, well, that's a voluntary payment. No lawsuit filed, so where's the insurance? And I just refer this court to pages, I think it's 19 to 30 of my brief. The law in this state, I believe, certainly the law in virtually every other state, and Couch on Insurance, all of the treatises we cited, are that if you in good faith put your insurer on notice of a claim, even before the lawsuit, and that's what happened here, and the insurer abandons you. Say the insurer says, and they may be in good faith in their own mind themselves, no coverage. What are you supposed to do? The law is, in Wisconsin, that you have a duty to mitigate this anticipatory breach and at least freeze things for the time being. Don't let one other person get sick on the farm next door. Don't let somebody clean this up for $24,000 when you can do it for $10,000. Don't incur $27,500 in fines a day. Stop the bleeding. Stop the bleeding. When you stop the bleeding, then you go back against your insurer and you say you were mistaken. You do owe this. And that's where the judiciary comes in, and maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. But if you're right, the insurance company is stopped from saying that this is a voluntary payment, that somehow this is a violation of the duty to cooperate, and so forth. This depends on your having given notice to the insurer. And, Your Honors, we gave notice to these insurers in every one of these cases well in advance of any of these payments. And the insurance companies determined that there was no coverage, and therefore we proceeded reasonably. In one case I'm aware of, we decided that the science that the government was presenting to us didn't justify the level of cleanup, and we told them that. And litigation ensued, and we ultimately settled. We didn't just blindly respond even to all potentially responsible party letters. But there is very, very good reason for me to stand before this court to say this isn't something casual, this isn't something voluntary, this is something where some very, very savvy owners of businesses around the country have looked at it, they understand the danger, they have strict liability under CERCLA. It's not a question of a normal liability suit about statute of limitations expiring, or somebody is more negligent than I was. The strict liability, and the government can go against any potentially responsible party. And I think it is in the best interest of public policy. It's in the best interest, frankly, of reaffirming Wisconsin mitigation law, that principle be affirmed. Now,
counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you several times in argument have mentioned the term costs and assess that. One of the arguments made is the kind of costs and unsettling effect that accepting your position will have, that is, overruling Edgerton. The argument is advanced that striking down this framework would lead to uncertainty and confusion. The argument is advanced that this court has provided the lower courts and litigants with a workable framework for handling these cases, that we've had many opportunities to revisit Edgerton and have consistently declined to overrule it. Almost from an institutional point of view, precedent, can you advance the argument of why, the contrary argument to this, why now, in view of uncertainty and confusion that may arise from overruling this, we should do it?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, an excellent question, and I think it really invites response on two levels. One level is the what policy considerations should or does this court take into effect in overruling the prior decision? You don't do it lightly, and you shouldn't do it lightly. And secondly, if you do were to consider it in this case, why would you do it in this case? Pardon me, was Edgerton improperly decided, and why am I right that the CERCLA response costs are damages? Let me start with the first question that you asked, and that is the sort of the talismanic response to why you overrule cases, I think everyone knows, and that is if it is, developments have ensued, that it's no longer workable to continue with that decision, that there are new facts, and so forth. The truth of the matter is, Your Honor, we only have to look to what has happened since 1994 in the state of Wisconsin, much less the rest of the country. One of the amici notes in his brief that something like 13 of 15 of the high courts in this country have come to an opposite conclusion on damages. But putting that aside for a moment, I've read the Court of Appeals cases. I've read them from Spick and Span to Amcas to Nortel. I've read them to Hydrite. I've read all of these cases. And I must say that I have never seen an area of the law that became more unsettled as a result of a Supreme Court opinion than settled. There is enormous confusion out there resulting in the most unsettled decision of all, which was Johnson Controls 2, which is why I'm here today. Take a look at Johnson Controls 2, four categories, which there seems to be no authority for any one of these categories. The courts of appeals have interpreted your decisions, rightly or wrongly, in Edgerton and Hills to mean that if the government is a plaintiff, there's no recovery, despite the fact that there's no exclusion. The courts of appeals have decided that even if the government isn't a plaintiff, if it even had its pinky on the scale early in the game, there's no coverage. And they've also come to the conclusion that even if it's a private party that sues you, if the government had earlier on asked you for information, there's no coverage. There's no exclusion like any of that in these CGL policies, and there's no authority for that in Edgerton. But more importantly, if this Edgerton is not overruled, and if a definitive statement is not made as the law in this area, I am afraid that this divergence among various, even circuit courts in this state, courts of appeals in the state, will continue. To address your question as to why the definition of damages that I am propounding is, I believe, the correct one, I would first of all read the opinion in Hills that simply says that it's the law of the state, and it's long been it, that the cost of repairing and restoring damaged property and water is a proper measure. But much more importantly, take a look at the intellectual progeny of Edgerton, which is Shorewood. Even Shorewood, and I want to say this at the outset, if someone were to ask me, should this court overrule Shorewood? I believe you should. I believe Shorewood was wrongly decided. But I also believe, pardon me?
Second time.
The second time, you're right. Thank you.
No problem.
Shorewood too. And the reason is this, in all candor, and that is that, but it very candidly is a very candid decision, and it said we're going to take a very technical definition of damages, and that is contrary to the law of the state. It's not what the layman would have understood. A layman does not understand what a court. The notion of a court in equity has the whiff of a horsehair wig to it. And the average small business owner wouldn't have the faintest idea what it is. But more importantly, Shorewood did say something that's very important to this case. And Shorewood said the form of the litigation makes no difference, whether it's equity or law. Shorewood said that. And Shorewood also said damages looks back for past correction. Injunctions look forward for correction of future conduct. To be honest with you, I'm not sure that that's an exactly precise statement of the law anyway. But taking it at its face, the fact is, I can assure you, we have nothing in this case that's prospective. This is for clay caps put on and berms put on, technologies to contain and to clean groundwater on these Superfund sites. If this is not damages, I'm not sure what is damages in the context of the cleanup of environmental costs. Now, the question of the PRP letters, the question of the UAO, the question of the cost recovery, I commend to this court's attention a couple of cases in particular that we cited. One of them is the Weyerhaeuser case in Washington, Washington Supreme Court. And I want to address something that went on in that case that I know is in the back of the mind of many people in the court as a legitimate issue. It's, Matt, where do we draw the line? Okay, there's no lawsuit filed. We're not expecting people to wait to be hammered with $25,000 a day costs. But, Matt, you know, just because some do-good company wants to clean something up with just a fuzzy request, I mean, where do you draw the line? Weyerhaeuser didn't even involve a potentially responsible party letter. In Weyerhaeuser, the company, in advance of that, just decided that in conjunction with the regulatory authority, that it should clean up the pollution. What the Washington Supreme Court said was, the strict liability of CERCLA is the liability for the damages. And their ability to do this in advance of more coercive administrative or legal proceedings should be commended because it stopped this pollution. You don't even have to go that far. I'm not asking in this case that you even go that far. I think it was rightly decided. I think that if I'm standing in front of you 2 years from now on those facts, I would say it was rightly decided. But we had a PRP letter. And a PRP letter is the start of something adversarial and coercive and extremely dangerous and extremely costly. I commend the Utah case to you, Quaker State, in which the full panoply of harsh things that can happen to somebody who ignores a PRP is set out in some detail. The Indiana case, Travelers Indemnity, who said, you know, the other half of that CGL policy says, and I just want to read it, says, the company shall have the right and duty to defend any suit against the insured seeking damages on account of such property damages. That's separate from the duty to indemnify. I mean, that's separate from the duty to pay all sums legally obligated. In this case, you don't even have to get to the duty to defend, in my judgment, because we put our insurers on notice and they abandon us, and therefore we did what we had to do. But there's a respectable body of law around the country, which we cited to this court, that increasingly has been speaking with one voice that says that the word suit is ambiguous. Justice Abrahamson, dissent, I believe, in Edgerton made that point, and I think that point's made by a lot of other judges. And that is, if you were to ask the average person, the average store owner, what is a suit? Is it a UAO order, 107 order? What is it? He would know what you were talking about. Your Honor, I see the amber light is on. I want to thank you very much. I'd like to reserve the...
You have another 5 minutes, Mr. Flynn.
I do. Well, thank you very much, Your Honor.
And then 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Oh, yeah, thank you very much. That's right, because Well, if I may say then, on several other cases, on the owned property exclusion, I would request that this court not read and own property exclusion in as a matter of common law. It's what if there's an exclusion on the property. Otherwise, it's an all-risk property policy. It is true that there are owned property exclusions in many of these policies, and I understand that. But I think I explained that there's three of them, and that in one of them, it involves water in Michigan, where the water is owned by Michigan, and one involves water in Indiana, but it went on to a third property. The one in Georgia does not involve water. It only involves land, and it's no problem.
Let me just ask you this. Your first line of attack is that we overrule Edgerton.
Correct, Your Honor.
Maybe Shorewood, too.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And you obviously know that my stance, at least in earlier years, was in agreement with you.
Yes.
Whether it is now or not, I remain to be convinced. Open mind, right? Suppose that we're unwilling to overturn Edgerton and Shorewood because the doctrine of stare decisis is really quite a strong one. And many times I've joined with an opinion I totally disagreed with because it was already decided and we just go along. But so suppose we don't overturn, then what Then I assume that if you fall within the Edgerton, any of the facts in the case that fall within Edgerton, you're out. Right?
Well, this is...
Go ahead. You got four categories, right. Okay? So one would be Edgerton. That would be an out. Two would be Hills. You get covered. And then three or four sort of new ones for this court, right?
Right.
So assuming we keep Edgerton, and assuming we keep Shorewood, can you still win on categories three and four?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. And it's an interesting question, because I would say this, and I want to say this to every member of this court. You could keep Edgerton and Shorewood, but I think my own reading of Justice Crook's decision in Hills is that the court may have intended to limit Edgerton to either the own property exclusion or the fact that a PRP letter is not assumed. There's some suggestion of that. If that's true...
The PRP is not assumed.
Yeah. If that's true, in this particular case, let's assume it isn't assumed. We still were threatened with what ultimately would have matured into a UAO action or cost recovery action, and we did what we'd do in a car accident. And so we should win on all four categories. But to address, let's say you disagree with me on that, Your Honor, and you're just talking about categories three and four. Here's the nub of it. Category three said that there was no recovery if the government is a plaintiff in a cost recovery action. And category four said no recovery if a private party is a plaintiff in a cost recovery action, if we had a prior notice from the government. And I would simply say this, Your Honor, there's nowhere in the CGL policy that suggests that if the government is a plaintiff, there is no coverage. That is an exclusion. CGLs were marketed as unknown hazard policies in the 40s, changed insurance completely. They were marketed, sleep well at night, extra tag-on premiums for them, which then became rolled into CGL policies. With regard to the Category 4, that's Hills. I mean, that's just clearly Hills. There's no basis in Edgerton to say that just because we got a request for information, for instance, or we got a PRP letter, and remember one thing, Your Honor, most of these are hybrid sites. One of the fallacies of the Court of Appeals opinion is that somehow this is all cleanly delineated. Many of these sites, the minute Johnson Controls got sued by the government or a private party, they settled and paid. But prior work had gone on before we were even notified. We weren't blowing anybody off. And so I think that if you were not to overrule Edgerton, but I want to stress that I request that you overrule Edgerton and that you reverse the Court of Appeals in total. But if you don't, I think that Edgerton does not control Categories 3 and 4. I think that Hills does, and normal Wisconsin law about CGL policies and exclusions. Thank you very much.
Chief, if I may, I was under the impression that Category 2 was the Hills case.
It is.
Okay.
No, but that's what the Court of Appeals said. I suggest that Category 4 is also a Hills category because it's a private party suing, and there's no intellectual basis to say that just because we got a letter. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. We'll now hear from attorney, and is it Ruskoski? Counsel, you are you admitted in Wisconsin?
Yes.
Okay.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Scott Ruskoski with the Larson King firm. I represent defendant respondent Employers Insurance of Wausau. This court's decision in Edgerton and its decision 2 years later in Hills, combined with a series of published Court of Appeals opinions, have established a simple and easily applied framework for determining whether an insured's environmental costs are damages recoverable under liability insurance policies. In the 8 years since this court issued its decision in Edgerton, there have been dozens of Court of Appeals opinions and trial court decisions that have been based on this framework. There also have been hundreds of environmental insurance coverage claims that have been resolved without the need for litigation based on this framework. The foundation of the framework is the court's holding in Edgerton that response costs incurred by an insured after the government has exercised its enforcement authority under CERCLA and identified the insured as a responsible party are not damages. although the Court of Appeals properly summarized the series of cases into four categories of sites, the gist of the framework that has developed is simply this. Once the government exercises its enforcement authority under CERCLA and identifies an insured as a responsible party, any response costs that the insured incurs are not damages. That's true regardless of whether those costs are incurred directly by the insured, which is Category 1, regardless of whether those costs are incurred as a result of a government lawsuit, which is Category 3, and regardless of whether those costs are incurred by the insured as a result of a private party lawsuit that's brought by the insured, brought against the insured, after the government has identified the insured as a responsible party and the insured failed to fully comply with a request or directive from the government. Other third parties are forced to do so and then bring suit against the insured.
How does that fit with the policy language? How does all of this encrusted case law, how does it fit with the policy language?
It fits with the policy language, Your Honor, because it's a correct application of the damages language, the as damages language, and the insuring agreement. The government has available to it, under CERCLA, two forms of relief. And again, as the case law notes, in the insurance setting, what we're looking for, what we're looking at, is what is the nature of the relief that's being sought from the insurer. And in CERCLA, there's two forms of relief that are available to the government, response costs and natural resource damages. This court in Edgerton held, properly so, that response costs are not legal damages, that response costs have as their primary function the protection of human health and the environment from future contamination. And particularly in Edgerton, this court distinguished response costs from natural resource damages, which are available under Section 107A4C of CERCLA, and specifically provide for the government to be compensated for loss of or damage to natural resources on behalf of the public.
Now, during Flynn, when he started out, read the CGL policy as damage. I'm just going to paraphrase this, as damages caused by an occurrence. Now, we have these four categories. I was here when Edgerton first came before the court. Then we have Cole's case, Justice Crook's, and then we have these other two. Now, I'd like you to categorize, if you could, how 3 and 4 fit into 2. In other words, 2 being Hills. How does Hills and how would Hills not cover 3 and 4?
Well, the critical difference between the Hills case and the Category 3 and 4 cases, Your Honor, is that in Category 3 and 4, the insured has been the subject of the government's environmental enforcement authority. In Category 3 or Category 4, the government has elected to exercise its enforcement authority under CERCLA and has identified the insured as a responsible party. In the Hills case, Don Hills, the service station owner, the insured in that case, was never the subject of any governmental request or directive. The government had not chosen to exercise its enforcement authority against Mr. Hills. It's a critical distinction because the government in Category 3 and 4 has elected to pursue the response cost remedy under CERCLA from the insured, which this court has held in Edgerton, was not legal damages.
Mm-hmm. And his argument, of course, is, look, if we had to wait around for all this, we're causing additional environmental damage. If we're talking about $25,000 a day, we're talking about government cleanup costs, which they can do for X number of dollars, we can really cheaply do just as good a job. But what you're saying is that, based on your answer, is that there is a definite difference between these categories we're talking about as far as the government action?
There's definitely a difference, and you're right, Your Honor. It would be improper for them to not respond to a government request or directive. But to hold that there would be a suit for damages under categories 3 and 4 and not under category 1, the Edgerton case, would give the parties an incentive, would give insureds incentives not to respond to government requests or directives, force, in the case of category 3, the taxpayers through the government to perform the response activities, and then wait for the government to file a lawsuit against the insurer so that the insurer could then argue that it was a suit seeking damages. The same analogy essentially in a category 4 situation. There would be an incentive for the insured not to respond to a request or directive, to ignore the government's demands, delaying the cleanups, making the cleanups more expensive. And what you would be doing in that setting is you'd actually be providing an economic advantage to insureds who choose not to respond and comply with their obligations under CERCLA. Because what you would be saying is, if you get a request or directive from the government and you perform under Edgerton, that's not those response costs are not damages. On the other hand, you'd be saying here that if you do not respond, and you force either the government, the taxpayers, or other private parties to undertake those response costs and those response activities, that you can somehow later get those costs back if you're subsequently sued by the government or private parties. You'd be providing an economic advantage to the party who fails to comply with their obligations under CERCLA. And you would be putting a significant monkey wrench in the enforcement abilities of the regulatory authorities both at a federal and a state level, because you would be putting them in a position where they're dealing with insureds and parties who have now an economic incentive not to comply with the government's directions and orders. And that certainly doesn't seem to be the public policy that this court should be encouraging.
You think it would be undercutting Edgerton if we know that categories 3 and 4 were covered by the insurance policy?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that categories 3 and 4 would be that you'd be undercutting the environmental enforcement authority's ability to enforce the laws.
Don't you think Hill undercuts Edgerton?
Does Hill undercut Edgerton? No, because in the Hill's case, the insured never received a government request or directive, was never identified by the government as a responsible party.
It makes a difference as to what damages are.
It makes a difference as to the nature of the relief that's being sought from the insured, yes. Because, again, CERCLA provides the government with two forms of available relief, response costs and natural resource damages. In Edgerton, we held that response costs are not damages because they have, as their primary purpose, the protection of human health and the environment, as opposed to natural resource damages, which expressly are for the purpose of compensating the public for loss of use or damage to natural resources.
What is the law in Minnesota, state you're from?
What is the law in Minnesota on the damages issue?
Yeah.
The law in Minnesota on the damages issue holds that CERCLA response costs are damages.
Are damages?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the Wausau Insurance do business in Minnesota?
Wausau Insurance Company does business in Minnesota.
So that if there were a Minnesota principal and a Minnesota site and Wausau Insurance, that would be covered?
Well, it would depend, Your Honor, on what state's law is determined by the court to apply to the policies at issue. Each state obviously has their own choice of law principles. So it would be difficult to answer that question without knowing what state the action was brought in and what the law was in the state as to determine the time.
You talked about economic advantages. It seems to me a Wisconsin corporation has economic disadvantages when it has sites out of state, when it's applying the law of Edgerton.
Wisconsin policyholder would have an economic disadvantage as applies to...
Let's say we're in a state where sewer cleanup costs are damages. And we have a number of sites to clean up in that state. If there's a Wisconsin-based policy, the insurance company doesn't have to pay. And the principal company has to pick up those costs. Whereas a company based in that state that owns a similar site, they're going to get insurance coverage. Isn't that disconcerting for people who like Wisconsin companies like me?
Well, perhaps, but representing a Wausau Wisconsin insurance company, I think it obviously it goes in both ways. But I think that what we have to consider here is that this court decided in 1994 in the Edgerton case that response costs are not damages under CERCLA. The court did so at a time when there were several other states that held to the contrary. The court issued its ruling in Edgerton fully aware of the fact that there were competing interpretations of the damages issue at that time. In the 8 years since then, there's been a significant framework of cases that I explained that has developed in the state. There's been significant reliance on that case law by the judiciary, by the practitioners like myself, and by the business community. Now, I don't think you can underestimate the fact that there have been a significant number of environmental insurance coverage claims that are being resolved and have been resolved in the state based on this framework.
That strikes me as an argument that I guess I tried to raise with my parents. That is that we've always done it that way. And you seem to be saying, well, we've always done it that way since 1994. And if we were wrong in 94, and all these cases that since then have been decided wrongly, why should we perpetuate that error?
Oh, I don't believe that they...
I know you don't, but for me, I mean, I have not been convinced at all that we were right. And that's the only way you get me is to convince me that stare decisis just trumps everything here. And it may well, because I recognize all the institutional arguments for stare decisis. But if it's wrong, if it's causing wrongful damages out there, why should we perpetuate a situation where next year another Johnson Controls gets nailed for $30 million or whatever, and the year after that, and the year after that? That also strikes me as being very wrong-headed.
Well, I don't think that you're perpetuating a wrong outcome, obviously, because I think the court got the outcome correctly in the Edgerton case.
I realize that. But grant me for just a moment that I think it's a wrong decision and that there is continuing wrong being done. You're asking us to perpetuate an error. I need you to convince me that that's... that somehow stare decisis trumps injustice to future litigants,
well,
or future corporations.
The court has established certain circumstances in which departure from stare decisis is permitted, and I don't think any of those apply in this case. And what you have to consider is if the court now decides in the year 2002 or 2003 that a contract term, the as damages term, that this court has examined in three separate settings and on three separate occasions held that term was plain and unambiguous. And now, more than 10 years later after that first occasion, the court decides to come back and say, we were wrong, that was that which we have said is plain and unambiguous really was not. That is going to do tremendous damage to the court's integrity. It's going to do tremendous damage to the ability of businesses and citizens in Wisconsin to rely upon the decisions that this court makes. And be concerned when the court says that this contractual provision is plain and unambiguous for fear that years later, some, in this case 10 years later, there have been decisions from other jurisdictions that have come back contrary, and now the court's going to come back and say, well, we made a mistake.
Mr. Roskowski, let me ask you this. Edgerton relied on federal court predictions in regard to what Missouri law was going to be, what Maryland law was going to be, and also what Professor Dobbs was saying. Your opponents say things are different in Missouri. The Missouri Supreme Court has spoken contrary to the prediction. Maryland, the Supreme Court has spoken contrary to the prediction. Dobbs has clarified what he meant or what he means in regard to this context. So the underpinnings of Edgerton have been eroded. How do you respond to that?
Sure, Your Honor. Well, I think it's important to remember that the basis of Edgerton is an examination of the nature of the relief that's available to the government under CERCLA. And I think the critical underpinning of the Edgerton case is not the citation to some federal court case applying Missouri law, but rather it's the distinction, the critical distinction in CERCLA between response costs and natural resource damages. And response costs have as their primary purpose the protection of human health and the environment. Natural resource damages, again, have they're designed to compensate the public for loss of natural resources or damage to them. And I think if you look carefully at the Edgerton case, that in fact the court reaches that holding based on an examination of the nature of the relief available under CERCLA. The court actually cites to the NEPACO and the ARMCO cases, the two cases that you mentioned, for support for the proposition that an insurance policy is not to be interpreted in a manner that fails to give meaning to all of the terms of the policy. I grant you that the NEPACO and ARMCO cases involve CERCLA response costs, but nonetheless, I think it's critically important to remember that what we're looking at in insurance coverage cases, particularly in the damages setting, is what is the nature of the relief that's being sought? And so you go back to the basis of the relief being sought by the government, which is CERCLA. As for Professor Dobbs, the provision of Professor Dobbs that's being cited in the briefing in this case is the exact same provision of Professor Dobbs' treatise that was cited in the Edgerton case. It was argued and re-argued in the principal briefs and in the amicus briefs in the Edgerton case. But the provision of Professor Dobbs that you see in the briefs today is the same provision of Professor Dobbs that existed at the time of the Edgerton case. And moreover, I guess I would say if you look at Professor Dobbs' analysis, he agrees that response costs have as their primary purpose the protection of human health and the environment, which is, of course, is the very basis of the court's holding in Edgerton that response costs are not damages as opposed to natural resource damages under Section 107A4C.
Could I ask you, since the Edgerton decision, what has happened in the insurance industry? How do buyers of insurance respond to the Edgerton decision so that they get some kind of protection?
Well, at the time of the Edgerton decision, which was 1994, by that point, the comprehensive general liability policy had what's called an absolute pollution exclusion or a total pollution exclusion, which is something I know the court's familiar with from other cases. And so the issue of the availability of coverage becomes a little bit different because there's an absolute pollution exclusion at that point. But there is, and was beginning in the late 1970s, early 1980s, there was specific insurance products available, specifically marketed for and issued for called environmental impairment liability policies. getting back to the point, the framework that we've talked about, this is not something new that the Court of Appeals grabbed out of a hat. The Court of Appeals simply summarized the case law from Edgerton on forward. As we've talked about, Category 1 is simply this court's holding in Edgerton. Category 2 is the court's holding in Hills. Category 3 is really encompassed within Edgerton, but it's also the Court of Appeals holding in the City of Manitowoc in 1996 and the AMCAS case in 1999. Category 4 is the logical extension of Hills and Edgerton, and it was the holding of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals applying Wisconsin law in the Wisconsin Power and Light case in 1997. And actually, the Court of Appeals simply set forth the law as those of us like myself who practice in this area on a daily basis already understood it to be. Most policyholders and insurance companies have organized their affairs, they conduct their business, they've set their business expectation based on this framework. Some policyholders certainly, including Johnson Controls, continue to refuse to accept that this in fact is the law.
How many more cases like this do we have? This must go back to old policies.
The number of cases that are presently pending in the state of Wisconsin, well, I don't know that there's any objective recording of that. As somebody who deals in this on a daily basis, I can tell you that the number of cases pending in the state are, a number of pending with environmental insurance coverage cases in the state are as low as I've ever seen.
Well, they must be running out because the policies are old.
Well, I don't know so much, Your Honor, that it's that the policies are old, but the environmental law that gives rise to these actions, CERCLA, was enacted in 1980, so we've had, 22 years of enforcement by the government, and so I think it's more a function of the entities that are typically identified as responsible parties have been identified. The government enforcement authorities have had 22 years to identify sites, and so the process of government enforcement activity, response costs, insurance coverage issues arising has largely, yes, run its course.
You responded to me the lowest you've seen. What is it? What's the number?
What's the number?
Yeah, just from your company.
From Wausau right now, I am aware of two other cases that are pending in the state courts of Wisconsin. And both of those cases are essentially on a stay until this decision.
But are they categories 3 and 4?
They are, well, we would argue that they're category 1, but yes, they are, let me put it this way, rather than saying what category they are situations where an insured received a PRP letter, and the insured ultimately entered into a consent decree with the government, and the consent decree was lodged by virtue of a government lawsuit. They are actually identical to the City of Manitowoc case because they actually were other potentially responsible parties along with the City of Manitowoc at the Lemberger landfills in Manitowoc County. And so, of course, our argument in that case is this has already been resolved by the City of Manitowoc case, which this court denied the petition for review on in 1996, but the court has, at the policyholder's request, stayed the case essentially pending the court's decision in this case.
You're relying on stare decisis then?
We're relying on stare decisis, but on top of that, Your Honor, we're relying on the fact that we believe the court properly analyzed the language of the policy and the court properly analyzed and understood the nature of the relief available to the government under CERCLA. And the significant difference between response costs and natural resource damages. When the government elects to exercise its authority to pursue response costs, it's pursuing relief that's primarily intended to prevent future contamination. On the other hand, natural
resources. The whole tort damages are always to prevent future losses. It's a deterrent.
Well, in this case, though, the CERCLA specifically provides for compensatory damages by way of the Section 107A4C, and not by way of response costs.
And can they be the same number, that is, dollars, under both?
No. In fact, they I would submit that they cannot be the same number at all. That, in fact, as we explained in a little bit more detail in our brief, the process of response costs is handled by the Environmental Protection Agency, whereas the process of natural resource damage assessments is handled by a separate governmental entity, the Department of Interior. And while they certainly are designed to work in tandem, they absolutely are not going to cover the same thing. Because they have a fundamentally different purpose. The fundamental purpose of the response cost is to prevent future contamination. And that's why many of the activities that you see in response actions are of that type. They include things like putting a fence around a site to prevent humans from having contact with the contaminants. They include imposing deed restrictions on the property so that future development does not allow the contact of humans with the site. They include putting a cap on a landfill to prevent additional moisture from entering the landfill and causing additional contamination. They include putting up barrier wells at the perimeter of a site to prevent groundwater from exiting the site, all again designed to prevent future contamination and to protect human health.
What happens when a non-governmental third party brings an injunctive action against the defendant to put up this fence around with no prior notification by the federal government? Is there coverage?
I would argue no, Your Honor, that in that case that's a classic situation that's not damages. That's a classic situation of a party seeking an injunctive remedy, which is not legal damages going back to Shorewood.
Okay. With Hills, you have a cause of action for contribution.
Correct.
Okay. What differentiates the second category, Hills category, from the fourth category? That is the only differentiation prior governmental notification?
The significant differences in that case is that the government and categories 3 and 4 have exercised its authority to pursue response costs from the insurer. In Category 2 did not take place. And remember that in the Hills case, that case involved a lawsuit that was brought by somebody who was the owner of the property.
Mm-hmm. And if I may, Chief.
Go ahead.
And in Category 4, where it is the third party, non-government, who does the remediation, remediates the site. If that third party would bring a cause of action for contribution, not equitable relief, then the only thing that differentiates that cause of action, if it's contribution, from Hills, again, is the prior government notification. Is that?
That would be the prior governmental notification, but I think it isn't just as simple as saying that, because you have to look at what the impact would be if you would say there is a suit seeking damages in a Category 4 setting. Because, again, what you would be doing is you'd be providing an economic incentive to parties who receive government requests or directives not to comply, force other parties to undertake those response costs, which will delay the cleanup, make the cleanups more expensive, result in more litigation. And so you would be significantly impairing the cleanup of the environment, the government's enforcement activities, and you would actually be providing an economic advantage, an incentive for a party to ignore a government request or directive. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We have David Wall.
Well, I'm very sorry. Somebody else.
Mr. Wall, you are not a member of the Wisconsin Bar.
That's correct.
Okay, Ms. Rhodes.
Yes, Your Honor. It's Janice Rhodes, and it's my great pleasure to introduce David Wall to the court today. He comes to us from Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett in New York. He's a lifetime New Yorker, graduate of Dartmouth College, Brooklyn Law School, and clerked for a federal district judge in New Jersey, Mr. David Wall.
You're admitted for arguing at this moment, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and thanks for the privilege of appearing before this court. I represent the Travelers Indemnity Company, and with respect to Travelers, this case or this appeal only involves five sites. That's as a result of an order that was entered in January of 1993 dismissing the Globe Union-related sites with respect to Travelers. So the claims currently against Travelers in this case arise out of the controls group of Johnson Controls, and as I say, that involves five sites. Of those five sites, Johnson Controls concedes that three of them fall within the Edgerton ruling, and other than this court overturning Edgerton, Johnson Control concedes that we win on those three sites. And those sites are Lakeland, National Steel and Tube, and the Goshen site. In urging the court to overrule the Edgerton decision, Johnson Controls is asking the court to take contract terms that it has previously found to have clear and unambiguous meanings, namely suit and damages, and to now hold that these terms mean something completely different than the court previously said they meant. Nothing has changed that is relevant to the contract interpretation rules that were applied by this court in Shorewood, Edgerton, Hills, or WPS. It's many of the same rules that Mr. Flynn recited when he got up to give his argument, that in any way warrant or justify overturning these decisions. As this court pointed out in the Hills case, the focus of the analysis must be the interpretation of the insurance contracts and not on the environmental law or the impact on environmental law that the plain terms of the contracts may have. Thus, arguments as to what judicial results will or won't promote environmental cleanup or ease administration are frankly beside the point. The key dispositive issue before the Court of Appeals and in the precedents of this court, which the Court of Appeals faithfully applied, is what do the terms suit and damages mean in the context of a CGL policy? This court has found that suit means a lawsuit filed in a court of law, and damages does not include response costs under CERCLA or similar state regulatory statutes. It is difficult to imagine anything that would be more contrary to the principles of stare decisis than JCI's request that this court now announce that these terms, again, mean something completely different. The CERCLA statute that this court interpreted in Edgerton is the same. The contract language that this court interpreted in Edgerton and in Hills and in Shorewood and WPS is the same. The only thing that's changed is that Johnson Controls is seeking for the court now to reverse its prior decisions. That is not sufficient to overcome the very important principles underlying the doctrine of stare decisis. And I further submit that to address some of the concerns that the court has raised with respect to inconsistency in withholdings in other jurisdictions, or even concern that maybe the court got it wrong in the Edgerton case, and that the impact of that might be negative for Wisconsin companies. The only way, I submit, for the court to navigate those issues is to keep its eye on the ball respectfully and focus on the contract terms and the rules of contract construction that the court applied in Shorewood and Edgerton and in Hills. And those rules have not changed and do not give rise to any basis for reversal. With respect to Hills and the categories 3 and 4, I wanted to make one quick point, and that is to echo something that co-counsel said. In Hills, the court specifically drew the distinction between the Hills situation, where Mr. Hills had not been called upon or identified by the court, by the government, as a potentially responsible party in connection with the cleanup. And in fact, the Hills case, in distinguishing Edgerton, specifically said, as its first grounds for distinguishing Edgerton, that unlike Edgerton, quote, neither the EPA nor DNR have requested or directed Hills to develop a remediation plan or incur a remediation of response costs under CERCLA or an equivalent state statute. I see that the light is on and my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Mr. Flynn, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd like to address several things right from the outset. And that is, an excellent point was made and discussed, and that is, stare decisis does have meaning. It's important. And why, in this case, despite the fact that there may be sound policy reasons to believe that Edgerton was wrongly decided, should this court overrule Edgerton? And I think I would look to on page 3 of our reply brief. We have cited other cases where this court has overruled some of its prior precedent. But more importantly, the criteria for overruling, trumping stare decisis. Are there changes or developments in the law that undermine the rationale behind a decision? Is there a need to make a decision correspond to newly ascertained facts? Or is there a showing that the precedent has become detrimental to coherence and consistency in the law? I think that all three of those apply, but I'd like to speak to the last one in particular. I don't think that anyone can fairly say that in the last 8 years there has been consistency and coherence in the law of environmental insurance in the state. And I think that words such as credibility, integrity, and so on were used by opposing counsel. But the worst thing that can happen is that there is massive incoherence, courts of appeals suggesting that these are arbitrary distinctions, but they have to obey them. And more importantly, overruling by a thousand cuts. Hills clearly overrules Edgerton in some respects. It could be another case that would do it again and again. That's not the way to do it. If there is a good faith understanding that Edgerton, and Edgerton is unique among Wisconsin cases because Wisconsin doesn't generally overrule cases. No one thinks it does. And generally its decisions are on target and are right, and even litigants who lose understand the basis for them. It's a rare case that should be overruled. But that isn't to say no case should be overruled. And if any case should be overruled in the last 10 years in this state, it's Edgerton. I think...
How much is at stake in this case? What are the dollars we're talking about?
Your Honor, in terms of what we paid out in so far in cost recovery actions, whether they're 107, 113, and so on, I believe it's somewhere between $1 and $2 million. That's very rough, and I've not consulted that part of the record. We do also have, and I strongly believe, whether we sit back and let the pollution get worse and somebody else clean it up more expensive, or whether we do it ourselves, I think that this case could rise into the tens of millions of dollars if we looked at all of the costs, and I want to stress that they're all past costs. We are not seeking a number in damages on this appeal, but I think that it would be less than $35 million, $40 or $35 million. Much of it costs that we incurred to clean up. And there are, I want to share this with the court, there is a case right now pending in Judge Hayes's court. Judge Hayes retired. Judge Gooley has it now. That's between the same parties, where they sued us for declaratory judgment. We counterclaim, and it's been stayed pending this. That will, I'm taking into account those cases as well as the ones here. There are also several of our sites in which there's ongoing scrutiny in potential litigation. And so this is very much an alive issue. Now, the other thing I'd like to say is everything that has been said in this case on the part of the insurance companies is of great interest, it's well stated, it's well written, but it isn't in the CGL policy. This is an insurance case. There's not a special CGL policy for insurance, or a special CGL policy for environmental cases. There's no, these don't have a stamp on them that say, warning environmental case. It's a CGL policy. It's an unknown hazard policy in which extra premiums were sought and extra premiums were paid, built into the CGL premium, because the insurance company and their actuaries are far better positioned than a small business person in Wisconsin to assess the likelihood of unknown hazards. You can assess it. If we had actuaries here, if we had used statistics and probability and factorials, we could assess, if we took a look at the number of court decisions in the last 60 years, if we took a look at the number of change legislations imposing new burdens, costed them out, spread them out over time, we could come to a guesstimate, a pretty good one, as to the likelihood of that happening again. We build it into our premium. That's what's happening here. One other thing I'd like to say, Your Honor, categories in 3 or 4 are based on a fugitive intentional acts. I see my time is up. I'm sorry.
Well, when you finish.
Thank you very much. This whole question of an intentional acts exclusion, that's separate from what is being stated in these cases. An intentional acts exclusion is, if I or my vice president dumps oil in the river just to get rid of it, that's an intentional act at the time of the occurrence. It's an occurrence that caused the intentional act, and there's no coverage. But to say it's an intentional act not to respond to a PRP letter early, in other words, sit back and get sued, we in effect are darned if we do and darned if we don't. If we respond, there's no suit, and we shouldn't have been voluntary. And if we wait till the end, we're intentional, and we're caught in between. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Thank you, Mr. Wall and Mr. Rakowski, for your arguments in Johnson Controls and that. And you're no longer representing a Broa. That concludes our argument in 01-1193, Johnson Controls versus Employers Insurance. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45 p.m.
Do you have any relatives in Stevens Point? You do. And,